monsters that confine their eerie appearances to singular geographic locales weave a tapestry of mystery. These enigmatic creatures become part of the very essence of their surroundings, their tales whispered among the locals. Their isolated presence adds a layer of intrigue, inviting us to ponder the unique forces that shape their existence within a specific corner of the world. Welcome to Paranormal Patio, the podcast that brings you one step closer to the paranormal and occult, one patio at a time. Joining us on this paranormal journey are our intrepid guides, Jason and Cody. Pull up a chair. In this episode, we're embarking on a spine-tingling expedition into the world of two one-off monsters that defy the boundaries of reality while completely respecting their own. First on our eerie journey is the Enfield Horror, a creature that terrorized the small town of Enfield, Illinois in the spring of 1973. This curious beast stood on three legs, had grayish-green skin, and was reported to possess eyes as big as flashlights, each glowing like embers from the abyss. Its appearance left a trail of dread and bewilderment among witnesses as they grappled with the notion that such a monstrous entity could exist. Our second enigma, Ayamish, hails from the remote reaches of Patagonia, a land steeped in folklore and mystery. Described as a cross between a giant otter and a ground sloth with large fangs, Ayamish has been a figure of fascination and fear for generations. So, fellow explorers of the unexplained, prepare yourselves for a journey that will test the limits of your imagination. Join us as we delve deeper into these extraordinary tales, illuminating the strange and wondrous corners of our mysterious world.
Welcome back to Paranormal Patio. As always, I am Jason. Usually, Keith would be right here. Keith is still sick.
Ugh.
So, since we're talking about one-off monsters on this episode, I wanted to have our own one-off monster in my good friend Cody.
Hey, how are you?
You might remember Cody from the very first ever live stream that I did back... It's been a few years ago. My goodness. Yeah, it was when I announced the documentary.
How's that going, by the way?
Yeah. Yep. Still going. Still going. Cody has graciously stepped in to fill the seat of Keith while he recovers, and we hope that Keith has a speedy recovery. And tonight, the episode, A Typical Disturbance. As in atypical, not like a typical disturbance.
But atypical.
Atypical. It's a one-off thing. Something that doesn't happen very often. The first story, our local-ish story, just under 2 hours away south of us, the Enfield Horror. And that's a fun story. It's one of my favorites of all time, Cody. I know that you didn't know about the story ahead of time.
About 4 hours ago, I found out this story.
It's a great story. One of my all-time favorites. Been on my radar for a really, really long time. And then we're going to travel to South America in, I believe, the 1800s. Precisely, 1848. To talk about a weirdo monster, man. One of the weirdest monsters I've ever uncovered in my research. Don't even remember how I came across it. But it's a good story, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Cody comes with us today via the Gristled Up podcast.
Yes, yes.
And right here down the road, like 4 minutes-ish.
If that.
If the traffic's heavy. the headquarters of Gristled Up, they graciously had me on the show before Halloween.
Yep.
Had a great time. Check out Gristled Up. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. But right now, it's time. We're going to put Cody to the test.
We got big shoes to fill tonight.
Big shoes to fill. To fill in for Keith and read us the wonderful tale of the Enfield Monster.
All right.
Take it away.
Let's paint the scene. It's 10 p.m., April 25th, 1973, Enfield, Illinois. A scratching sound coming from the front door of Mr. Henry McDaniel catches his ear and causes him to investigate. He looks out the window and sees what he thinks may be a black bear in front of his house. He grabs his flashlight and gun and heads for the door. At the time, Mr. McDaniel was unaware that a chilling encounter had taken place earlier that evening in his small, sleepy town. About 30 minutes before Henry McDaniel grabbed his .22 pistol, a young man named Greg Garrett had been attacked while playing in his backyard. Apparently an unusual beast, to say the least.
No kidding.
Had charged him, stamping his feet with its three clawed foot-like appendages, tearing his shoes to shreds. Yeah, messed that one up.
Can we get a new copy for Cody, please? This is 2 weeks shoes. In a row.
At least the original guy messed it up last week.
Yeah, the original guy. Me. I've messed it up every time.
Okay. In terror and absolute fear, he runs back into his house. Now this beast had set its sight on the McDaniel household. As Henry opened his front door, he saw before him a creature the likes of which he had never seen. The creature appeared to have three legs, claws, gray and slimy skin, and haunting red eyes. Henry fires the first shot, knows he has hit the creature, but the creature didn't drop or run. Instead, this beast hissed at McDaniel as he unloaded four more shots into it. The barrage of gunfire sent the creature tearing off into the darkness, bounding nearly 50 feet in a series of just three short jumps.
That's pretty impressive.
It's very impressive.
I can almost do that.
On a very good day, downhill and I trip. I can cover a lot of ground quickly. The creature disappeared in the brush alongside the railroad behind McDaniel's home. Henry promptly called the local authorities, but when Illinois state troopers who responded to the call arrived at the scene, the only evidence of the encounter that remained was a series of scratches in the side of McDaniel's home and dog-like footprints in the yard. What made the prints so unusual was the fact that they had six toe pads, and even more intriguing, that they represented a three-footed animal, with one track being slightly smaller than the others. Very curious.
It does line up.
It does.
Let's see where those six-toed, three-legged footprints lead us, Cody.
Well, I got it right here somewhere.
Oh, okay.
If McDaniel believed that that his encounters with the unknown were a thing of the past, he would soon realize that he was sadly mistaken. When, on the eve of May 6th, he was startled awake in the dead of the night by the howling of some neighborhood dogs. McDaniel pulled himself out of bed once again, claimed his firearm, and with what must have been great trepidation, opened his front door. But this time, his encounter with this creature would not be so intimate. He claims he watched the thing at some distance, languidly negotiating the trestles of the railroad tracks near his home.
You know, this is otherwise beautifully written.
It is.
There's the one snafu.
I just blame that on my reading skills.
No, hey.
Lots of big words.
Full representation and responsibility.
But, like we talked before this, if I'm hearing scratching on the house and all this, the last thing I'm going to do is grab a small firearm like that.
Well, okay. We did discuss this. Now, for him to easily just grab it from around the door area.
It had to have been laying
out. It had to have been just like, in case a robber tries to break in the front door, there's like a side table up against the wall. I have an image of it in my mind. Now, none of us were there.
Right.
Admittedly, I wasn't there. And neither was Cody. We were probably not born. But he would have probably had, like, you know, a pistol laying on the table.
Mm-hmm.
He looks out, grabs it. He's ready to go, thinking still at that point that it could be a bear,
mm-hmm.
which in the area that this took place, the bear in question would not have been a polar bear or a grizzly bear or a panda bear.
Sure.
It would have been a black bear, right? Now, we don't have a whole lot of black bears sighted in our southern Illinois-ish Wabash Valley area.
But there have been some.
There have been some. So, for him to think it had to have been a bear based on the size, that would have scared off a black bear.
Sure, sure. And knowing the abouts where the area is at, there could have been multiple things play into it. He could have been out hunting earlier the day or yeah. whatever. I mean, tons of things could play into this.
Yeah.
It's just when you sit there and think about something knocking on the door, that's the last thing that I would think about grabbing. But anyways.
Instinct. You got to have something. Like, at least he didn't grab a bat.
That's fair.
At least it was something he could get a little range
out. Smacking the trash can lid. All right. So, White County Sheriff Roy Posher Jr. was so perturbed by the sudden influx of press and curiosity seekers, not to mention the alarm that was settling in on the locals. He threatened to incarcerate McDaniel if he didn't stop inciting panic by spreading his wildly terrifying tale. To make matters worse, well-armed, possessive amateur monster hunters began patrolling the area near the L&N railroad track sightings. It was on one such expedition that five young men allegedly had a run-in with a creature identical to the one that Garrett McDaniel encountered, with the notable addition being that they described the thing as being hairy.
Hmm.
The men discovered the beast hiding in the underbrush and proceeded to open fire on it. But, much like in the McDaniel case, their bullets were unable to cause mortal injury, and the monster bolted off at a speed that the eyewitnesses surmised is greatly in excess of any that a human being could achieve. The men were supposedly arrested. The final eyewitness to this improbable creature was Rick Rainbow, the news director of radio station WWKI in Kokomo, Indiana. He and three other unnamed individuals claimed to have seen a gray, stooping, 5-foot-tall entity lurking outside an abandoned house not far from the Garrett McDaniel homes. This would be the last reporting sighting of the Enfield Horror.
Hmm.
But Greg Garrett, the boy who reported his shoes being destroyed by the creature, later told Western Illinois University researchers that his report was a hoax to tease Mr. M and have fun with an out-of-town newsman. Because his report was uncovered after McDaniel had made his report, despite him saying it happened before, this could be true.
Could be true.
And I wouldn't put it past a young kid just trying to pull one over on somebody.
Sure.
Go along with it.
But it goes back to the unusual footprints.
Yeah.
And the fact that other people had independently seen the creature.
Sure. So what? We'll get to that after this. It raises some questions for you.
It does.
The incidents were reported widely in the press at the time. It appeared in newspapers throughout the state on April 27th, 1973. And on May 7th, there was an interview on radio station WGN, Chicago, and articles in the Chicago Daily News, the Moline Dispatch, Champaign-Urbana Courier, and the Alton Telegraph. There were earlier articles in the Carmi Times, and an updated summary of the events appeared in Pennsylvania's Reading Eagle in August 1973. After the arrest of the five men who had arrived to hunt the creature, residents of Enfield expressed fears that press coverage would lead to further monster hunters who might inadvertently shoot citizens or livestock.
A legitimate fear?
Sure. You get mass hysteria going, you're hard telling what's going
to
happen.
That's two callbacks to previous episodes. Carmi and mass hysteria. It's almost like it's engineered.
It's almost like it was wrote on script.
Almost.
It was suggested that the creature may have been a kangaroo that escaped from a nearby zoo. which would explain the three legs.
This is the story.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Description is, the tails of kangaroos look like a third leg.
Uh-huh.
Yes, but if you're looking at tracks, you should be able to tell that a tail's slapping around. And
no. I don't know that kangaroos have six toes, but I guarantee they don't have six toes on their tail.
Or three legs.
Or three legs. The tail could potentially, but you'd think it'd be like a...
Right.
Like a divot every so often.
Sure. Or like a rat tail running through the dirt or a lizard. So, I find that one very hard to believe.
Yes.
Just personal opinion.
Well, you know, like, go back to almost any encounter with the other across time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always somebody who's trying to give, like, the most plausible sounding explanation. Kill the story and kill any panic that might come from it.
Right.
Especially dealing with UFO cases, and you had Project Blue Book and J. Allen Hynek coining like swamp gas up in Michigan. You know, blame ball lightning on things. And like, yeah. A kangaroo, although the most ridiculous explanation ever, seems on par with that. You know, they called the Mothman a great heron or whatever, and like, although they're really big birds, it doesn't match the description of any of the eyewitnesses. Right. So, yeah.
Grasping at straws, again, trying to keep everybody in check.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway. McDaniel was adamant that the creature wasn't no kangaroo. Having owned such a creature as a...
That's a direct quote. That wasn't no kangaroo.
Having owned such a creature as a pet while on military service in Australia, and noting that kangaroos have narrow faces and tracks that leave claw marks, following media coverage of the creature, an Ohio man contacted a local newspaper stating that the creature may have been his pet kangaroo, Macy, which had been lost or stolen a year previously.
What are the odds? Okay, this random dude in Southern Illinois has this encounter. The explanation that comes forward is it's probably a kangaroo. He's like, no, hold on. I had a kangaroo once. And if that's not enough, someone else close by is like, ah, it could have been my kangaroo, Macy, got out.
But being from this area, you know as well as I do, the odds of this happening are...
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
It could happen.
Very, very likely.
One of my friends had an alligator. Kept it in a swimming pool in the barn until it got too big.
That's fantastic.
That's legit, you know? Like, people... Like, especially around here, we had a lot of people when I was growing up that had big cats. And even today, there's, you know, over by Indiana, around Terre Haute.
Mm-hmm.
There's that big cat sanctuary.
So it really wouldn't be a surprise if something like that got loose. But that's funny.
The stars are just properly aligned for that cover story, though. Like, for it to be a kangaroo. Like, oh, there's too many people who have input that can relate to a kangaroo sighting in the story.
And Joe Schmo walking out. A few days after the event, United Press International quoted an anthropology student who suggested that the creature may have been a wild ape, noting that such animals had been reported throughout the Mississippi area since 1941. In 1978, researchers at Western Illinois University, headed by David L. Miller, investigated and analyzed the incident, publishing it as a case study, if I could read, in Social Contagion. The researchers found there were no more than three first-hand reports that had subsequently been exaggerated by news stories and local gossip into an epidemic.
Hysteria.
There we go. According to the study, in this area of Southern Illinois, it is not unreasonable to assume Mr. McDaniel or the radio news team had actually seen an animal. People we interviewed framed the recent events in these terms. Their accounts admitted the possibility that large dogs, calves, bears, deer, and wildcats had been sighted. Some frames suggested that an exotic pet, such as an ape or a kangaroo, was the catalyst for the monster reports. Finally, some people tactfully suggested that Mr. McDaniel had a notoriously overactive imagination and had probably been shooting at shadows. In any event, we interviewed only one person who agreed with Mr. McDaniel's claim that he had indeed seen a monster from outer space.
So, like I had mentioned before, this is one of my favorite, like, weirdo monster stories, right? I don't even remember when or how, but I talked to someone who lived in Enfield online. It might have been way back in the days of using ICQ, Instant Messenger, or shortly after, like on MySpace or something. But it was a girl around our age. Like, I remember I was like, oh, so you live in Enfield, huh? How about that Enfield horror story? And she was like, yeah. My dad has lived here his whole life, which would have put him in this time period.
Sure.
And he says that the guy who said he saw it was a drunk and was always telling stories. And so, you know, it's not uncommon for people who have sightings of things to get, you know, put down in public and gossiped about. So
that's maybe he actually did see something and all the negativity that surrounded it drove him to being the neighborhood drunk.
Possibly. Yeah, it did not clarify the timeline. But it could have also been a case of, like, Boy Who Cried Wolf, you know? Like, sure. He'd been saying crazy shit for decades, and then all of a sudden something really happened. Or maybe it's all made up. I don't know. You know, I'd like to find out. But it's impossible to find out.
It's very unfortunate.
It is.
It'd be cool, like, maybe in the upcoming years, maybe some of his family have reports or pictures or maybe he dedicated his life to proving that this happened.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think so.
Probably not, but
he's probably too busy, like, getting spray paint off the side of his house and buying a new tire every other day from people messing with him, you know?
Oh, yeah. Just add some spice to the story. Spice. So years later, Greg Garrett, the kid who may or may not have been trying to hoax the story to make fun of McDaniel, was sitting on his porch in Enfield when his wife, Rosie, shot him in the back, ending his life. The murder charges were later dropped, and her plea of self-defense kept her out of prison.
Interesting twist on the story there.
Yes.
Yeah, that was, I remember when I found that out, I was like, man, that is a little wild, you know, like, sure, people get killed by their spouses, you know, on the reg, but for it to be someone who's involved in this whole monster business, like, it's a little weird.
Bury the secrets with him.
He took them. I mean, it's the same kid who came out and said, you know, I made it up, but I don't know, man. It's another dead end. Can't ask him.
That's true.
I guess you could ask the wife. But, you know, who knows?
So what do you think?
I want to believe, man.
I want to believe all of it.
Put me on the X-Files. Like, I want to believe. It's one of my favorite stories. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, whether or not it really happened, I don't know. I'm inclined to think that it did. I think the tracks that they found, like, even if this guy was a town drunk and made stuff up, like, what are his capabilities for fooling anyone with tracks in the ground? And I don't think that the kid made it up. I think the kid said later on, yeah, I made it up, because his parents probably pressured him, like, hey, like, don't be talking about this stuff. You're going to be labeled a crazy person for the rest of your life, you know? Like,
kids are very impressionable, especially around that age.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody could have told him that it was just your imagination. Sure. Or so.
Yeah.
I'm like you, though. I want to believe. I think it'd be wild.
Yeah. I found one guy who went to, like, where the house used to be. I don't think it's there anymore. Like, I think it's been torn down. and filmed there. So at least I know kind of what it looks like. I wonder if I can find that video again. It's been a while. He was like a podcaster type of guy, you know, like had a YouTube show or something and went there to show what it all looked like and everything. But that was a long time ago too. I think it was long enough ago that the maximum quality on the YouTube player was like 360p. Like, it's been a minute since I've seen it. But yeah, no, I hope it's real. Like, I hope that's a true story because it's got a special place in my heart. I don't know why. It just does. I like the idea of a
three-legged
18-toed kangaroo running around out there and hanging out and tearing up kids' shoes and scratching at a door to come in. Like, you know, that's another thing. Like, the scratching at the door. Like, there are so many reports of encounters with monsters, Bigfoot, whatever, of them, like, trying to get into a door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this is really some, you know, let's say it's some alien creature crash-landed here or whatever. Okay, that's not what's ever implied, but for the sake of conversation.
Sure.
It had to have been around houses and people long enough to see people going into things shaped as doors.
Sure.
And disappearing and thinking to itself, okay, there's probably people on the other side of that door. I have to get through that door. But they're fooled by the simple design of a doorknob. So aliens not being able to open doors is weird to me. They're smart enough to build spacecraft to travel across the universe.
They can't do a quarter turn on a handle.
You'd think a doorknob wouldn't be enough to fool them. Or that they would have some sort of supernatural ability to just go through a door, you know? Which there's a lot of stories about aliens going through doors and walls, you know, just like ghosts. Yeah, man, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of things in this, like mm-hmm. a lot of pieces to this story.
Oh, yeah. I would find it hard to believe that it was a bear as well, because just coming from like a hunting background and stuff like that, they are not very gentle creatures.
No.
So if they're just going up and like...
But they are curious.
They are. Very curious animals. But they're not just going to come up and kind of knock around on the door. They're going to be throwing their weight into it.
Sure.
And the mitts on them things are huge. So, yeah.
But I've never encountered a bear or a picture of a bear or a bear story where they had extra digits on the fingies.
Right.
You know.
I don't know, man.
It goes back to those tracks, dude. Like, either they're real tracks from... One of two possibilities, the real tracks from this monster that this guy saw, or the real tracks from a real animal that somehow overlapped in a way
mm-hmm.
that the toe pads made it look as if there were six toes,
mm-hmm.
which if it's three footprints, right? Like one back leg meeting the front leg on the same side. And overlapping the pads. I mean, it'd be so awkward for an animal to walk like that.
Right.
Unless there's something wrong with it.
I was going to say a wounded animal.
But even still, you wouldn't think it would go that fast if it were wounded.
Sure.
Because again, the distance covered.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know, dude. Like, that's one of the things that hangs you up on it. Like, thinking that it might be real is the tracks. And I wish there were pictures of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one had the foresight, I guess, to...
And it would be really hard to fake those. Like, there'd be a lot of time and dedication into faking
yeah.
these supposed tracks that were laying around out there.
Yeah, sure.
So.
I don't know, man.
I think it was definitely something.
Yeah.
Something not normal.
Yeah. It's someone with a bit of a hunting background. If you were going to make up a story about a monster... Would you make it up in a way that you would have grabbed a smaller gun to make yourself seem more of a threat on your own? Or would you have made up the story and said, well, I grabbed my cannon out of the basement and drug it up the stairs and pointed it at the door? Like,
I would drag the cannon. Like, I would have to try to play this thing to where it was the size of Godzilla walking around.
Yeah.
And I was saving the world.
All right. I don't know.
There's a lot that plays into it.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot that plays into that story, as well as the next story. But before we get into our travel to South America, this would be where we would stop and do an interview with the guest. But this isn't a typical disturbance. So, Mr. Cody.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about Gristled Up. First off, where did Gristled Up come from, the name of the podcast?
Well, I'm told I say it all the time at work whenever I get excited about something. So, my fellow hosts decided that would be a funny name because they were quoting me. As you kind of touched base on, this is not my area of expertise.
No. And I appreciate you coming and being a part of it anyway.
Oh, yeah. This is stuff that has always interested me, and I've always enjoyed reading just weird stories or anything like this. So it's definitely a pleasure being on here. But our show is more of a comedy, slapstick kind of thing.
Yeah. The Christmas special is a prime example of this. Yes. I laughed a lot.
Good. That's what we're going for.
And I had the spoilers. I knew what the gifts were going to be. It was still funny.
But the raw reaction, getting it out of the guys, it was fantastic.
Terrific. Absolutely terrific. I had a great time on the show.
Good. Hopefully we can get you back on there sometime.
Well, I was told when I put the documentary out 2 months ago to come on back.
Wow. We'll be starting season 6 and probably still.
God, I hope not. I hope not. I do have private information for you about said documentary.
Ooh.
There has been a development.
Speaking of spicy.
Spicy. yeah. But anyway, yeah, Gristled Up, definitely. It's irreverent comedy that you don't find on this channel.
Yes.
And most of the time, probably kid-friendly, but teenager-friendly anyway.
Yeah. If you've got kids, view it by yourself first, and then decide if you want the kids to watch. But,
No, it's been awesome watching you guys start up and learn and grow. And it's cool not only to have someone else in the area doing something similar, but for it to be you guys who I'm friends with. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's cool, you know, to be able to offer to lend a hand for whatever, you know.
And you've been a huge help. We've reached out to you as far as figuring out our audio and.
Yeah. We're getting there.
Yeah.
We're going to get
slowly
her.
Slowly but surely.
We're going to get her. Dude, this show started with myself and John Hosier in my patio with PS3 headsets and a Chromebook. It's a little better now.
It's, yeah.
You know.
This is what we're shooting for, the big times.
I don't know that I'd call this the big time.
I don't know. Whenever I found out I was going to be on tonight, I actually got a hold of the guys and told them I got called up to the major leagues. Said I'll remember them while I'm on top.
I hope somebody texts you like, how's the view from out there?
That's everything I thought it would be.
Yeah, right on Jason's shoulder, so, you know, automatically 6'4".
Well, yeah.
No, but keep it up. You know, I'm glad that you guys haven't fizzled out and dropped away. You were telling me about a special episode you guys have coming up, which is going to be funny.
Yes.
And fun.
It is our official start of season 2.
All right.
So, January 16th. So, hopefully we can roll through the rest of this year as smooth as what we did last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And Gristled Up's on YouTube and all the socials, except, well, Facebook and Instagram, right?
Yes, we're not on Twitter.
I believe it's called X now.
We're not on Twitter.
So stupid.
We're we're talking about, put now that we're getting our audio figured out, putting everything on Spotify. We just haven't reached that decision yet, but
yeah,
it is coming.
Big things in store for Gristled Up.
Oh, baby.
Oh, baby. Shoe buddy. That shoe buddy thing. my friend Kyle Cadell down in Somerset, Kentucky, does that as an impression of someone that I've never met, but he does it so frequently that it's rubbed off. So every so often I go through phases of shoe buddy and things, and we're in the middle of one.
Ooh.
So buckle up. Shoe buddy. So, yeah, we're going to travel not only in time, but in space. And by space, I mean distance. I do not mean outer space. Possibly outer space. I don't
know. We're just going to see where this trip takes us.
We are going to talk about the Iamish. And I guarantee you haven't heard of this one.
I also guarantee.
And I guarantee at least 30% of you watching this have never heard of this. It's probably much higher. This is such a weird story. And it's in South America. So hopefully, you know, on Spotify, it gives you a breakdown of like where people listen to your show at.
Mm-hmm.
I do well in Asia. And I do well in the States, Canada, UK. I don't know that I have anyone in South America listening to the show. I blame that on the fact that I don't speak Spanish well. And I'm going to pull that card immediately. I do not speak Spanish well. Forgive my pronunciations. Every episode this season, I give Keith the local story. It takes place here. Here. And I go all over God's country, all over the earth, and I talk about things that are written in languages I can't read, by people whose names I can't pronounce, in places I've never heard of. I do it to myself.
I'm just glad I could keep up with Keith, where I've messed up two or three times reading the local story. So,
well, one of them is my fault, I guess. Another typo. Whoever is doing the copy edit around here. Just not worth a darn. Not worth a hoot. But shoe buddy, we're moving on. So, beginning around 1848, a ferocious and aggressive aquatic creature has been stalking the rivers of Patagonia. All right, you with me so far?
Oh, yeah.
This South American beast, known as the Iamish, or the water tiger, is said to look like a cross between a puma and an otter. It ranges in size, with the largest Iamish being around the size of an ox. There's this old video game, PC game, made by Microsoft, called Impossible Creatures. Remember this?
I don't know if I've heard of that.
It's like a top-down, it's like isometric top-down strategy, kind of in the vein of Command & Conquer, sort of. But the idea is, you get DNA samples from the animals on the map, and then you can mix any two of them together to make impossible creatures.
Hmm.
And you know, based on what abilities and statistics that animal has on that map or whatever, they're more or less effective. Like you can mix a bumblebee with a rhinoceros, have flying rhinos that shoot stingers, like all kinds of crazy stuff. Hmm. This is an impossible creature story, if I ever did hear one.
Yeah.
That's what drew me to it. According to the description of the Amagino brothers, the Iamish is larger than a puma, but with a wider body, shorter legs, and a long, flat, prehensile tail. And it is covered in short, stiff, reddish-brown or brown-colored hair. Its head is said to be short with large fangs and no rudimentary external ears, while its paws are described as plantigrade, with three webbed digits on the forepaws and four on the hind paws. Neither of which is six. Probably not a kangaroo. Each one armed with a formidable claw. Nocturnal and amphibious, it was allegedly greatly feared and was said to be powerful enough to seize horses with its claws and drag them into the water. It supposedly lives in caves and other protected areas along the shorelines of lakes and rivers. So far, this sounds like the absolutely most made-up thing I've ever heard of in my life.
Yeah. Like an episode of Animorphs.
There's nothing that is relatable in any of this. This is a quote. The animal is of nocturnal habits and said to be so strong that it can seize horses with its claws and drag them into the bottom of the water. According to the description I have been given, it is a short head, big canine teeth, no external ears. Its feet are short and plantigrade, 3 toes in the front, 4 toes on the hind. 3 toes are formed by a membrane for swimming and are also armed with formidable claws. Its tail is long, flat, and prehensile, as I just mentioned. That is from Florentino Ameghino. Carlos Ameghino wrote that he had been told the Amish once ranged as far north as the Rio Negro, living in all the lakes of the oriental foothills of the Andes up to the very Strait of Magellan. However, by 1898, it was said to be restricted to central Patagonia, specifically lakes Colhue, Huapi, Fontana, and Buenos Aires, and the rivers Singuer, Aysén, and Huemules. H-U-E-M-U-L-E-S. Huemules. According to Carlos, around 1848, an Amish swam down the Santa Cruz River from the Andean lakes and was seen by the Teoleche on the northern shore of the river near Isla Pavon. Terrified of the powerful monster of the Teoleche, all fled inland, and as of 1898, that region of the river was allegedly still called Amish Aiken, or the place of the Amish. In 1897, Florentino Ameghino claimed to have acquired his Neomylodon hide from an animal killed very recently, which he said had been called Amish by the Teoleche. According to a letter from his brother Carlos, which he published, Carlos acquired the hide from Teoleche, who owned it. Carlos also interviewed a Teoleche named Hompen, who claimed that while going by the Sanguir in Santa Cruz, he met an Amish on the road, which closed his way, and he fought it, killing it by hitting it with his bolas.
Wow.
Powerful dude.
I'm saying.
These brothers are suspicious. However, according to the Argentine surveyor and politician Florencio de Basaldúa, who had previously interviewed Ameghino, the specimens were flayed from an animal killed by Hompen himself on the shores of Lake Colhue Huapi, which is fed by the Sangre River. The true provenance of Ameghino's hide is unknown, and it has been suggested that Ameghino made the story up when rivals began to suspect that the specimens were from the Cueva del Milodon. 1900, we're moving through time here.
Mm-hmm.
The French paleontologist André Tournoyer, T-O-U-R-N-O-U-E with two dots above it, R, claimed to have seen a very similar animal called by his guide Himche in an unidentified river during his second Patagonian expedition, which was from September of 1899 to June of 1900. So, what is that? It's what, like 10 months?
Mm.
7 months? Neither of those are right. Lying in wait one evening on the bank of a river in the interior, beside which I had pitched my camp, I saw emerge in the middle of the stream the head of an animal the size of a large puma. I fired. The animal dived and did not reappear. As far as I could see in the dusk, its round head had dark brown fur. Its eyes were encircled with light yellow hair, stretched in a thin line to the ear hole. There was no external ear. I described it to the Indian who acted as my guide. He seemed very frightened and assured me I had seen the mysterious Himche. In 1921, shortly before 1922, the family of Epuyen-based American Martin Sheffield had a number of encounters with an Amish-like animal, later characterized as a plesiosaur. This is a totally different description.
Yeah, that took a left turn.
Left turn. Hard left turn. The encounters began when Sheffield's daughter Juana and two others discovered tracks like those of a cart in a boggy region near a small lake, surrounded by broken plants. Juana believed the trackway had been made by a long-bodied animal with short legs, which had squashed the plants with its torso as it passed. This does not sound like a plesiosaur, basically known to live in the water. Later, Juana and her younger brother, Conde, were sent to retrieve a horse, which they tracked to a reed-choked lake where their dog became distressed. And I quote, "Then I looked and saw the trail that was below us that had gotten into the pool and came out the other side. It was there that I saw something that was half red, half yellowish, nearly the color of a leather sole. The animal's fur was like hairs or feathers. They looked like hairs. We did not see its tail or head. We saw part of its torso. It was lying there, sleeping in the sun." Juana and Conde quickly fled the scene. Juana later recalled that the trackway had passed over a dead cow, indicating that this animal was not carnivorous. Some days later, she heard a bellowing or roaring, similar to that of a two-year-old calf, emanating from a backwater of the Epuyan River. She and another went to investigate and saw the beast in the water with the fish boiling above it. So, why they said it was plesiosaur-like, I have no idea. No idea whatsoever. Yeah. And I couldn't figure it out when I put this copy together, and I can't figure it out now. But this is also, yeah, this is also from a couple of kids.
Sure.
Yeah. And it doesn't say how old they were. I didn't look them up. They could still be alive.
Again, going back to a child's imagination, it's really hard telling what they could have came up with.
Absolutely. Martin Sheffield subsequently contacted zoologist Clemente Onelli, who put together an expedition to search for the animal, which he believed to be Neomyelodon listei. But by the time they searched the local waterways, all evidence was gone, as was the alleged animal itself. Onelli deliberately put out exaggerated and misplaced stories describing long-necked plesiosaur-like animals in order to throw off any rival expeditions. There we go. Okay. That's one mystery solved.
Thankfully. Dodge that bullet.
Now we're really skipping forward to 1995. Okay.
Hey.
A Sarmiento fisherman named Eloy Hutnick claimed to have seen a strange animal in Lake Colhuey Huapi, giving a description which matched that of a later eyewitness, Elias Guerrez. Guerrez's son, Nemesio, also claimed to have seen some very large beasts swimming in the lake around 1995. Now, 2001, farmer Elias Guerrez, previously mentioned, worker Albino Cardenas, and another unidentified worker claimed to have seen a bulky animal in Lake Colhuey Huapi on December 14, 2001, from the farm of cattle rancher Octavio Gonzalez. The sighting occurred at 9 a.m. in broad daylight when the men were around 600 yards from the lake. They caught sight of something big and strange moving in the lake, could not make it out due to the distance. Using a glass, Guerrez was able to get a better view. Now, I assume they mean like a looking glass.
Yeah.
Not just
a Coke bottle.
Yeah. You never know.
That's fair.
2001, all bets were off.
Well, being in South America, you really don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't.
Yeah.
The animal disappeared among the reeds and grasses, but after about 3 or 4 minutes, that thing reappeared again on the surface in reference to Nahuatl, the Nahoe Huape monster. The citizens of Sarmiento nicknamed Lake Colhuey Huapi's monster Colhuey Hapito. Okay. Now that we've struggled through that. 2014, correspondent Austin Whittle claimed to have recently seen an Iamish while driving to Puerto Natales in Chile. It crossed the road in front of the man and his wife, forcing them to break their car suddenly, then went on its way as if oblivious to their presence. The correspondent felt that the animal had looked almost identical to Whittle's illustration of the Iamish, but it had appeared more heavy-set, as if it were pregnant.
The plot thickens.
It does thicken. For 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, so couple of theories for you. Florentino Ameghino and later Clemente Onelli believed that the Iamish corresponded to Ameghino's hypothetical extent Mylodontid ground sloth Neomyelodon listei. You know, Neomyelodon is not that hard to pronounce.
It is the first time.
And the second and the third time. Leading to Ameghino to suggest that the sloth, already described as a burrower, was also aquatic. Imagino's theory came under attack even at the time, and he later defended himself in a letter to Hermann von Ehring, dated April 4th, 1901, writing that the references to Amish are exploited in ill faith. I have simply referred to the descriptions of a large mammal that inhabits the Patagonian lakes. If these descriptions are not reliable, the blame is not mine. Probably there is not only one mysterious mammal living in Patagonia, but several. Imagino's rival, Francisco Moreno, argued that the Amish may be a giant rodent similar to a capybara or the Cueva del Milodon's supposed Megamys, M-E-G-A-M-Y-S, which was described based on fragmentary remains now recognized as the femur of a camelid. Some later scientists and travelers were more critical of the Amish's existence in any form. Paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson considered that stories of the Amish, if not invented to amuse the stupid white men, were simply myths with no foundation in reality. Sounds suspicious for an explanation. I'm on team I Amish here. Huevelmans wrote that Imagino had probably gone completely astray in accepting the theory that the Amish was a ground sloth, arguing that its aggressive, horse-killing behavior, amphibious lifestyle, and canine teeth were at odds with a herbivorous, terrestrial ground sloth. Agreed. Mm-hmm. A member of a clade which frequently lacks canines. Furthermore, it is reported that Imagino later altered details such as Amish's number of digits to better fit a ground sloth. However, one late Pleistocene ground sloth of South America, the hippopotamus-like Lestodon armatus of northern Argentina, is now sometimes argued to have been semi-aquatic and certainly had prominent but sexually dimorphic tusk-like caniform teeth. Furthermore, based on isotopic evidence published in 2021, Mylodon itself occasionally consumed meat, possibly as an opportunistic scavenger. So, yeah, he's saying this guy is trying to make it seem like it's a big ground sloth. That doesn't add up, and it might be this hippopotamus-like, semi-aquatic, sometimes carnivorous monster. But both of which would have been extinct at the time of their sighting. So,
or so they thought.
Or so they thought. No, it's not uncommon. Like Loch Ness Monster, people describe as a plesiosaur. They really describe it as a plesiosaur.
Mm-hmm.
Not these two kids making it up. You know, and pterodactyl-like flying lizard things are seen a lot. Yeah. And have been for a long time. I just read a story the other day out of like South Dakota or something where someone claims that they were driving and saw a velociraptor run across the road. Like, still does happen.
Right.
You know, maybe it's like a ghost of a dinosaur or a ghost of a giant hippopotamus ground sloth.
It hasn't passed over yet.
Maybe it's like the recurring hauntings, you know, like people have a non-intelligent haunting just repeating something that it did while it was alive. At any rate.
Getting loose from Hollow Earth.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. You know, maybe. You know, you say that. I'm going to put a picture up. Up there. And I'll show you the picture. Because it's a little wild, actually, that you say that. Look up the artwork from Metadorpa, folks. Anyway. A more likely theory is that of a simple otter. Mylodon hunter Hesketh Pritchard, who saw a very large otter in the Sengar River, suggested in 1902 that there seems to be little reason to doubt that the Amish was a giant otter, which he connected with Patagonian stories of water tigers, and André Tourneur eventually came to the same conclusion. Bernard Huvelmans noted that most of the names applied to the Amish are used to describe a sort of otter, which Robert Lehmann Nietzsche identified as the marine otter, the Lantra felina. Although Ramon Lista believed that the Tehuelque otter was a species unique to southern Patagonia. For instance, the Tehuelche term for otter is Jamaican or Yimchin for nutria. Similar names were used for seals. The Aonineke term for sea wolf was Iumchin, And the Southern Patagonian name for the southern elephant seal was Yabich. The Yamich amphibious lifestyle, short head, lack of ears, long flat tail, and low slung body are all in agreement with such an identity. Le Maniche suggested that the Yamich itself was not feared, but had been confused with the jaguar, which once had a greater range, in terms of both habitat and geography, than at present, extending as far south as the Straits of Magellan. A larger subspecies, which inhabited open habitats, the Pleistocene Magellanic, or the Patagonian jaguar, also lived as far south as Isla Grande de Tierra del Fuego, off southern Patagonia, and has sometimes been identified with Patagonian cave paintings dated to around 9,000 years ago. Ameghino's contemporary, Santiago Roth, believed that a Pleistocene big cat, the remains of which he had discovered in the Cueva del Milodon, might explain the Yamich, leading him to christen the fossil Felid Yamich listi in honor of Ramon Lista's alleged Neomylodon sighting. I got it right that time. These bones, once suggested to actually represent the short-faced bear Arctotherium, are now believed to have belonged to Panthera unca mesabrina. Huevelmans found Lehmann Nietzsche's argument of an otter jaguar confusion convincing. That's very confusing and not at all convincing. Although neither rejected the possibility that a larger species of otter could explain the Yamich, so could just be a big otter.
Yeah.
Similarly, Roy P. Mackle, while agreeing with an otter was likely behind the Yamich, rejected the theory that the animal's size and ferocity resulted from confusion with the jaguar, suggesting instead that the Yamich was an unknown species of giant aggressive otter, closely related to the giant river otter of the Amazon and the Pantanal, a theory first proposed by Pritchard himself. The giant river otter, known from as far south as Uruguay and northern Argentina, officially grows to between 5 and 6 feet, but lengths of 12 or even 20 feet have been reported.
Holy cow.
That's a big otter.
Big.
You know, like...
Yo, I picture otters, meh. Well, adorable fellas.
2 feet, yeah. Maybe. 20-foot otter?
Wow.
That would be terrifying. And a 6-foot otter could be confused with a jaguar.
Yeah.
In the light, absence of light, rather. I mean, stretched out, low, sleek.
Right.
Mm. Mm.
Eh.
How about that?
Hey, you did.
Carl Schuker also considers it likely that the Yamich is a giant otter, either an isolated population of Onura brasiliensis, or an unknown related species endemic to Patagonia. Mackle admitted that the Yamich's number of toes, 3 on the front, 4 on the back, was at variance with an otter, which all have 5 digits and don't have 6, but suggested some anatomical peculiarity could give the impression of fewer digits. Schuker also questions whether a giant otter would be as feared as the Yamich, given the Amazonian giant river otter is a shy animal, leading him to modify Le Maniche's argument, suggesting that the Yamich was confused with the Yaquaru, considered by him to be a possible aquatic Smilodon, which in turn was confused with the jaguar. Felipe Cadre, these people just keep coming up, also groups the Yamich with the Smilodon-like water tigers, such as the Yaquaru, Popoque, Aipa, and the Inzayo Yawa.
Yeah.
I got all of those right. Go ahead, look them up. While Smilodon population did range as far south as Patagonia during the late Pleistocene, Austin Whittle rejects such an identity for the Yamich itself on account of the Yamich's long tail, which is unlike the bobtail of the Smilodon. Okay. We got that cleared up. Because I was going to bring that up. I wasn't. I don't even know what these animals are supposed to look like.
No.
you know, these are local South American animals that are mostly being described by their scientific names, which are Latin. So,
good luck deciphering.
Good luck. Okay, good luck.
I'm sticking with the giant otter.
I think so too. Yeah. Whittle alternatively suggests a link with a species of long-necked seal or long-necked sea lion, which had been reported from both coasts of Patagonia and was on one occasion described as otter-headed. While admitting that the long-necked seal would have neither a long tail nor a clawed paws, he notes similarities in size, lack of ears, and long neck. Several cryptozoologists who also draw connections between sea serpents' lake monsters. Whittle suggests that the marine long-necked seal could have adapted to fresh water, migrating upstream into the Patagonian lakes. Tournoir, that name, that guy from earlier, believed the animal he saw was a carnivore and was certain that it was not Neomylodon due to the presence of canine teeth. Whittle, in light of the yellowish rings around the animal's eyes, suggests that it could have been a spectacled bear. Spectacled bears are not known from Patagonia, officially ranging only as far south as the most northerly point of Argentina. Although stray southern individuals may explain the encounter. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about in Enfield, all the way up here in Illinois in the 70s, was maybe thought it was a black bear, although they're not common. You do get the occasional straggler that comes through the area. Spectacle bears, I don't know. I don't know anything about them. I know what they look like. That's one animal that I've brought up that I could pick in a lineup. It's a spectacle bear.
Never even heard of it.
No. You should look it up. It's fascinating.
You say spectacle bear, I picture a bear with glasses.
That's kind of what it looks like.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah. It's a neat looking creature. They would probably be unable to reach Patagonia in the present day due to the natural barrier of deserts, but Whittle theorizes that a population could have migrated to the region during the Pleistocene and survived in the temperate Valdivian forests. Whittle also suggests that a bear might have been incorporated into the Tehuelche descriptions of the Ayamish. Whittle proposes a number of alternative identities, for the Ayamish allegedly seen in 2014, including an introduced beaver or American mink, a koipu, an otter such as the marine or Patagonian, or even a saipan.
Hmm.
So, these two brothers start seeing this creature and spreading these stories about seeing this creature. One of them claims he's got the hide of one. And multiple people are investigating this over 200 years, almost.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know, man. To me, something that big would have a hard time hiding in present day. But if it's something that's kind of carried over from, you know, the Pleistocene, you know, same argument could be made against Bigfoot, though. Like,
sure.
That's a big creature.
I'm going to stick with the giant otter.
Yeah.
I picture them to be halfway skittish.
Sure.
So, I don't know.
What do otters eat? Are they omnivorous? Are they eating both plants and animals? I know they eat shellfish and stuff.
I'm going to say.
So.
They'd have to be.
My friend Trevor is the otter expert, but he's not here.
Where's the phone to friend button?
He's got an unhealthy obsession with otters. He says they're adorable. They are.
Well, I was going to say, he's not wrong.
But a giant one might change his mind. Can you imagine a 20-foot otter? That's a big animal.
Like, I've played with the otters. You know how you can do that at the zoo and stuff? Could you imagine playing with a 20-foot one?
No.
It'd play with you. Yeah, it would hold you like a baby.
That's insane.
I didn't know the giant otter existed. Not up to that size.
Well, yeah, what did it say? Like a 6 to 8 foot average?
Yeah.
Which is still massive.
Yeah, that's our height.
Yeah.
That's a...
You're 6 foot, I'm 8 foot. I'm like...
Yeah, somewhere in there.
What are you, like 6'2", right?
Probably. Yeah, 6'1", 6'2".
Yeah, we're not that far
apart. Depends on if I wear heels or not.
You're always wearing heels. I don't know. I've only ever seen you with the heels on. But yeah, I don't know what to think. Like, so much of it seems fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that quote about a story being made up to scare the white guys. Like, loved it.
That one got me.
Like, I hope that's what it is. Like, you know, I hope it's some totally made up, like snipe hunting, you know, like
sure.
just to tease people who are unaware. I love those.
You're going to scare all these vacationers or visitors.
Yes, get out of here. Like, go back to running your own country. I really do hope that it's that. But I also really hope there's this massive
20-foot otter cruising around.
As if tigers aren't terrifying enough. It's the one animal that I'm legitimately afraid of. An aquatic tiger, basically. Like, that's
terrifying.
That's horrendous. Because it could chase you on the land and chase you in the water.
Like, yeah, like,
what are you going to do?
Not only that, but they can climb. There's no getting away.
Yeah, this thing had claws. No stories about it climbing, but theoretically, built like most animals that are capable of climbing things, it should be able to climb. I don't know, man. And then it's weird to me that they tried to frame it with the fake description of being like a plesiosaur to throw other people off the trail. Like, why are you trying to keep people away from discovering this thing? Like, you just want it to be your own, maybe. Like, I get that. Like, you're hoping you'll be able to scientifically prove the existence of this animal that has eluded discovery, right?
Sure.
But at the same time, without doing that, without proving that, all you're doing is making yourself, like, look really suspicious, I think.
I'll agree with that.
I don't know. I know that if I had to choose between the Enfield Horror Monster and the Iamish, probably would grab my .22 pistol and go for the Enfield Horror Monster.
And avoid the Iamish.
I would avoid the Iamish. Mostly because it might be mad that I butchered its name so many times. Well, and the name of everything that might be it.
Well, in your luck, you would know how to open up a doorknob. So. Yeah.
You're not wrong. That's probably what it could do. You know, man, like, I love the stories, though, where the explanations are just as confusing and improbable as the story of the sighting itself.
Leaves you wanting more. What, you want to do your own research and dig deeper into it.
Not deep enough that I want to confront that thing, though. Like, I'm good.
You're not booking a trip to South America to...
Nope. Let the Florentinos handle it. Seem to have a generational interest.
They do have one hell of a head start on you.
They do. They do. They do, for sure. Man, thank you so much for, stepping into Keith's shoes and seat and hanging out with me in the paranormal patio.
No problem. I've wanted to be on for... years now. Literal years now.
Literally years now. God, season 5. Whew. Shoo, buddy.
Shoo, buddy.
Season 5, episode 3. In the books. Whew. Atypical Disturbances.
The Enfield Horror.
Mm-hmm. The Iamish. Hey, before I let everyone go, did you know, Cody, that we have a hotline here at the Paranormal Patio? I was unaware of this. And I wanted to make sure to share the information. Apparently, you can leave a voicemail. You can send a text.
What?
Yeah. Whichever you want. You can call, but no one's going to answer it, I'm told. Huh. But there is a number for this said hotline, right? 765-665-6488. Ooh. Once again.
I'm going to say, can you repeat that?
I'm going to put it right down here on the screen somewhere. 765-665-6488. You can text. So leave us some feedback. Leave us a story you've heard. A suggestion. Mm-hmm. Whatever you want. Check out Grizzled Up on YouTube. And especially my episode.
Yes.
But no, all of them. If you're in for a good belly laugh... the Gristled Up podcast might be the ticket that you're looking for. So, thanks for having the show for me to enjoy.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Oh,
it's my pleasure. Blast.
We'll have to do it again the next time Keith is sick.
Yes, next time Keith, I can be your full-time temporary replacement.
Full-time temporary PRN. But if you do come back, this has no longer been in a typical disturbance.
That is true.
It'll become a typical disturbance.
We're used to those around these parts.
All right, guys. Next episode, we're talking about some UFO stuff, which kind of my bread and butter, you know, kind of my thing. And hopefully Keith will be back in proper form and health.
Yes.
And we'll be talking about Lucky Point, Indiana, which is over near the Vincennes area.
Hey.
And then we're going to do a little traveling to Kentucky. How about that? Yeah.
You do that frequently.
I do. I love it down there. It's beautiful. You know, I just go and I get in the car.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also visit www.paranormalpatio.com for links to this and other episodes, as well as become a Patreon member. For just $3 a month, you'll get access to this and future episodes in video format and get them before anyone else. From me, your mysterious narrator, CJ Wheelwright, and your hosts, Jason and Keith, please remember to douse the fire, pick up your trash, and come back to the paranormal patio. The Season 5 theme song is provided by Carl Casey at White Bat Audio.